Away, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. President Obama recently reaffirmed a goal he set early in his presidency of sending humans to Mars by the 2030s and returning them safely to Earth. In the first half of our program, we talked with an official from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy about manned spaceflight to Mars and the president's embrace of science and technology. In part two, we talk with the author of a new book that outlines the origin of almost everything, from the creation of the universe to civilization. In a recent article for a major U.S. TV network and at a recent science tech conference in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, President Obama revisited and restated a goal he made back in April 2010 as he spoke on space exploration in the 21st century at the John F. Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
By the mid-2030s, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow. And I expect to be around to see it.
Kristen Dorgolo is the chief of staff of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy in Washington. She joins us today to talk about the president's renewed focus of sending humans to the Red Planet in the 2030s and his focus on science and technology issues. Kristen, the planet Mars has been a popular topic over the past decade, especially following the successful landing and mission of NASA's Curiosity rover. Other countries have joined in the exploration of the Red Planet as well. So why are we so focused on Mars, and why is the goal of sending humans there so important?
So President Obama has been looking at how to reinvigorate the U.S. government space program since early in his administration. And Mars has been one of his goals in terms of sending a human mission to Mars in the 2030s and returning those humans back to Earth safely. But it's only one part of a broader strategy to look at ensuring that humans have a path to explore space and the solar system in a more permanent way. In fact, he said in his 2016 State of the Union, going to space to stay, not to visit. And so that's really what we're looking at in terms of a Mars goal, is both why the planet itself is so attractive from a research and a learning perspective about our solar system, but also as a means and a mechanism for developing the breakthrough technologies we need to have a more lasting and sustainable space exploration program, not just in the U.S., but internationally as well.
I like the way the president mentioned his goal of sending humans to Mars by 2030. It sounded an awful lot like JFK back in the 60s when he announced his ambitious moon project.
It's important to set these ambitious goals as a way to focus effort, right? So those moonshot goals or this Marsshot goal become very important to drive just enthusiasm in the public, interest in students who will become the Mars generation and will actually be taking that journey that we're envisioning in this goal, to encourage more of those students to pursue science, technology, engineering, and math. They're the ones we're going to need at the table solving these breakthrough technologies and conducting the research we need and being the explorers of the future. And so ambitious goals like this have many benefits, and one of them is that technology development, and another is inspiring students.
Can you please give us a little bit of an outline of the president's vision for Mars and how he expects it to be accomplished?
Absolutely. So when President Obama is thinking about this Mars goal and when NASA is looking at how to accomplish it with commercial partners and with international partners, a couple of approaches become key. One of them is making investments in breakthrough space technology. That has been a cornerstone of the president's space policy from the beginning of his administration. We have made new investments at NASA and have opened up technologies that have been created to the private sector. And so that's part one. How do we develop the breakthrough technologies, be they propulsion technologies or technologies such as deep space habitat modules that will allow astronauts to make these deep space journeys and be sustained in the process? That's part one, breakthrough technologies. Part two is looking at how we actually partner with the commercial sector in the United States and with international partners around the world to make a Mars journey sustainable and affordable. Through our collaborations with the commercial sector in the U.S., we are already opening up new capabilities to send cargo and soon crew to the International Space Station. In the president's recent announcements and descriptions of this journey to Mars, he also described a new commitment to developing deep space habitat technology with the commercial sector and with broader partnerships internationally. It is through those partnerships that we will be developing a more sustainable space economy and coming up with these technologies in a more affordable way.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, if we can, Kristen. What contributions do we expect from other nations around the world in accomplishing this goal of sending humans to Mars in the 2030s?
Absolutely. If you look at the successes that have been accomplished in space exploration to date, many, if not most, have been done through international collaboration. Sometimes those collaborations take the form of investments in research and development, where different countries are bringing forward new technologies to the table. Sometimes they have to do with the actual implementation and building of the mission technology that will go to space. Sometimes they are funding collaborations. The exact shape that collaboration will take for the journey to Mars will differ for each step along the way, but it's an absolutely critical step. And one of the amazing things about space is our ability to collaborate across borders and to inspire those collaborations on domestic and on Earth matters as well when we do that in space.
You know, 2030 is a mere 14 years away. What is being done to make that timeline of landing humans on Mars and bringing them back to Earth? Can you give us a bit of an overview of what we're expecting in the coming years?
Yes, so I think a very important next step is for us to move beyond low Earth orbit, where we are currently doing important research on the International Space Station, and move out into what NASA refers to as the proving ground of deep space out by the moon, where we'll be able to demonstrate some of these capabilities that I've described, such as those deep space habitats, ensure our astronauts there are safe and healthy, and that we have all of the capabilities we need to sustain them on these long deep space journeys. The work in the proving ground there is going to be critical for enabling the journey to Mars. We have also called for continued investments in something called the Asteroid Redirect Mission, where we're looking at further developing the propulsion technologies and other technologies that will enable astronauts to interact with a piece of an asteroid, and then from that step forward, moving towards a human mission to Mars. And so this is going to be a step-by-step process where we develop technologies, we test them in deeper space, we send astronauts for longer journeys until we're actually ready to make the final push to Mars.
Some of the people involved with sending people to Mars are also concerned about a variety of issues and feel that perhaps before sending humans to Mars, we should revisit the moon again. Your thoughts?
So certainly we will be in that proving ground near the moon. These deep space habitat modules will be a base of operations not just for U.S. astronauts from NASA, but we expect for the commercial and private sector as well. In the same way that NASA last week announced their path to work with the commercial sector to add new equipment and modules to the International Space Station, I expect that when we have deep space habitat technology out near the moon, that we will also be supportive of and encouraging of private sector efforts to return to the moon's surface to do research there at the moon. NASA's focus will continue to be on pushing out beyond that proving ground to Mars.
I want to step back a little bit, if I could, Kristen, and talk about, you had mentioned the education of the young people today. I remember being a child of the 1960s and the space race, that out of that era, a lot of concentration on engineering, science, mathematics, and it seems as though with the effort on STEM, that effort is being renewed. What kind of luck are we having with that in generating a new generation of young scientists, mathematicians, and engineers?
There is no question that if you look back at our race to get to the moon, our leadership in America at the time knew the importance of investment in science, math, technology education. For example, when President Eisenhower created NASA in that same time period, he devoted resources to science and math education. We are seeing the same push now from President Obama's administration in terms of investment in STEM education. One of the great outcomes we've seen is that for the first time, more than 100,000 engineers are graduating from American schools every year. And in addition, the president set an ambitious goal to train over 100,000 excellent new STEM teachers in a decade, and we're on track to accomplish that goal. To get those graduates of the future that are going to be the Mars generation, we don't just need to interest students in STEM and improve the image of STEM careers and STEM fields. We also need great teachers. So I'm pleased to say that we're on track to meet those goals.
And finally, Kristen, I noticed that among the goals of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy is to ensure that U.S. federal investments in science and technology are making the greatest possible contribution to economic prosperity, public health, environmental quality, and national security. How does President Obama's new Mars initiative accomplish this?
Well, when you look at the history of the space program to date and the technologies that have been developed to support space exploration, you see technologies coming out of NASA and out of other federal agencies that then get infused in the private sector and are used to make life better here on Earth. Some of that is an unintended success and surprise, things we can't predict when we begin basic research. And so those investments in basic research are critical, not just to getting us to Mars, but actually to improving life here on Earth as well. In fact, today, the Office of Science and Technology Policy announced additional steps to support the development and use of small satellite technology that will both help space exploration and our astronauts in space, but also help us here on Earth understand more about our home planet and to do so more cost-effectively and efficiently. And so that's the exact type of benefit we expect to see across technology development for the Mars goal, is how we actually bring that technology back home here to Earth and allow companies across the United States and the world to build on that technology to fuel economic prosperity at home.
That was Kristen Dorgolo, Chief of Staff of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy in Washington. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA, or send us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. We'll be back with more of our program after this.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
We're back with the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. My guest in our second segment today is Graham Lawton, executive editor of New Scientist magazine and the author of New Scientist, The Origin of Almost Everything. It's a book that outlines the origin of almost everything from the universe to civilization and is written in a way that's very easy to understand. Graham, we humans are a curious species. Of course, two of the biggest questions are, where did we come from and how did everything begin? Now, how do you and this book attempt to explain such complex questions?
I mean, I think it's really just part of human nature. I think that confronted with anything that we don't understand, the automatic response for a human being, for a human brain, is to say, where did that come from? And that, I think, extends from the very, very big, so things like the existence of ourselves, the universe, the earth, you know, the cosmos in general, to kind of even the small stuff, things like belly button fluff, for example. You know, you find some belly button fluff in your navel and you wonder, where did that come from? Like I say, I think that's just a natural response to almost every situation that we find ourselves in. And I think it's also a great motivator for scientific inquiry.
I'm curious, how did you pick the various topics you covered in your book?
Well, we go, as I say, from the biggest question of all, you know, why is there something rather than nothing, through to what you might consider to be quite trivial questions. But we try to capture the whole kind of sweep of the history of the universe. So the obvious starting point is the Big Bang. And then you get questions like, well, where did the chemical elements come from? Where did the solar system come from? What about the moon? What about meteorites? So those kind of cosmic questions about the universe. And then you can start to drill down a little bit closer to things on Earth, so you can ask things about, say, the weather or soil or fossil fuels. And then, obviously, the next big thing that happened was humans came. Well, but, you know, life evolved on Earth. Where did life come from? You know, a fundamental, fascinating question, scientific question. Lots of other things, dinosaurs, insects, where do those things come from? And then human life. And obviously, 15,000 years ago, humans underwent possibly the most amazing transition that's ever happened on planet Earth by inventing civilization. You know, 15,000 years ago, our ancestors were hunter-gatherers. Nowadays, we live in houses, we shop in supermarkets, we travel around in machines. How did that happen? And then, you know, even later, there was an intellectual revolution, and ideas like mathematics and zero and chemistry came along. And, you know, even more recently, we've had the technological revolution, mobile phones, x-rays, those kind of antibiotics, those kind of things. All of those things demand, I think, an origin story. So what we tried to do was to capture that entire sweep of the history of the universe and civilization and invention and technology in 53 chapters.
So would you mind if we do like a brief look through in your book?
By all means, far away.
Okay, first of all, chapter one, the universe, of course. How did it begin? What theory do you personally subscribe to? The Big Bang theory, steady state universe with no beginning or end, or the eternal inflation universe, which introduces the multiverse concept?
I can only really follow what my colleagues who are more au fait with modern physics tell me, and they tell me that the Big Bang theory is currently our best theory for the origin of the universe. Obviously, if you went back, I guess, even 50 years, the steady state theory would be the dominant theory, which says the universe has always been here and always will. But there's bits of evidence that suggest that's probably not true. When Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding, that was a huge shot in the arm for cosmologists. And that made them realize, actually, that you could, you know, if we could watch the universe going forwards in time, expanding, you could then rewind back. And when you do that, and this is what Stephen Hawking is most famous for doing, you end up coming to a thing called a singularity, a point where the universe shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks as you run the clock backwards until you get to a point where it's infinitesimally small, infinitesimally dense, and that's what we call the Big Bang. Now, that obviously raises questions of its own, because it suggests the universe sprang into existence spontaneously from nothing, which seems to be, to our human mind, seems to be impossible. But if you look at the laws of quantum mechanics, if you look at the fact that if you add up all the mass and all the energy in the universe, you get zero, what that tells us, we think, is that the universe did spring from nothing, and the universe still is actually nothing. This is nothing doing what comes naturally to nothing.
I understand that at the beginning, right after the Big Bang, there were basically only two elements that were around, hydrogen and helium. If this is the case, where did the other elements come from? How did they form?
So there was a little bit of lithium as well, but only a tiny smattering. So what scientists think, and again, I have to defer to scientists. I'm just a mere journalist who listens to what scientists tell him. We think they were forged inside stars. So a long time after the Big Bang, a billion years or so after the Big Bang, for complicated reasons that we probably haven't got time to go into right now, stars and galaxies started to form in the universe as hydrogen and helium coalesced together and formed ever bigger structures. One of the consequences of creating stars is that you squish those elements, hydrogen and helium, together, and they just form bigger and bigger and bigger elements. So you take two hydrogens, you get a helium. You take two heliums, you get a beryllium, and so it goes on. That way you can get up to iron, element 92 or so, and then it stops, the star explodes, and throws all of these elements out into space, where they coalesce again into yet more stars. There are other processes which create the bigger, heavier elements. But, you know, we think that all the elements that are in your body were created inside a star a long, long time ago and tossed out into the cosmos in a supernova.
Okay, chapter two. How and when did our solar system form?
So, again, we think that we know, and these are all, these historical sciences like cosmology, they're approximations, they're guesses. But from the best evidence that we've got, it's about 4.6 billion years ago, give or take. And again, this is a product, really, of those elements being tossed out into space and doing what the physics of gravity does naturally to things. It makes lumps of stuff coalesce together. And when you get a large, say, cloud of dust or something in the universe, that will eventually coalesce into a solar system like ours. So we think about 4.6 billion years ago, for want of a better word, a large clump of stuff came together. Most of it became the sun. Bits of it that were too far away from the sun to be gravitationally attracted to it became the planets, including the planet Earth.
Speaking of planet Earth, we have to admit that planet Earth is totally unique compared to the other planets of the solar system. It's made up of land and oceans. How did we get so lucky to have this variety of geography?
Yeah, that's another really big one. I mean, now, Arthur C. Clarke famously said how inappropriate he said that this planet is called Earth when it really should be called ocean, because if you look at the Earth, most of the surface is covered in ocean. And that makes it pretty unusual in our solar system, at least. We don't know about other solar systems. The other rocky planets, so Venus, Mars, Mercury, don't have oceans. They also don't have plate tectonics, so their continents don't move around in the same way that ours do. Why Earth has an ocean? We think, conjecture based on evidence that we've gathered, that it mostly came from space. Again, the early Earth would have been far too hot to retain any water that was in the primordial material that made up the Earth. But we also know the Earth was bombarded by comets and other impacts from the debris of the solar system, and they almost certainly brought water with them. So I think that if you look at the ocean, there's a huge quantity of water in there. Most of it, we think, arrived from space.
Speaking of comets and other objects hitting from Earth, getting into Chapter 3, life and the beginning of life on Earth, many scientists theorize that the key ingredients, some of the amino acids and proteins and other elements needed to sustain and create life, also came from comets and other objects. Your thoughts?
Yes, I think that's a pretty mainstream view now amongst what people who call themselves astrobiologists, which is people who study things like the origin of life and the relationship between life on Earth and possibly life in space. I mean, we know that the molecules must have been there because life originated, and it originated about 3.8 billion years ago, which is pretty quickly, actually, after the Earth formed, which is another bit of a mystery, because if the Earth is being bombarded by comets and meteorites and so on at that point, how does proto-life exists. But there are also ways in which those chemicals, amino acids, as you say, little bits of the chemicals that make DNA, fats and so on, there are also ways that those can be made on Earth, probably at the bottom of the ocean, in an environment called an alkaline hydrothermal vent, which are very interesting places for people who study the origins of life, because they pretty much contain all the ingredients that we think you might need to get life going. Now, the origin of life seems like a fantastical event and a massively improbable thing to have happened. But the people who study this now say, actually, we think you only really need three ingredients to get life going: seawater, carbon dioxide, and rock. Put those things together in the right combination, and life probably emerges quite quickly, quite spontaneously.
Evolution. We came from basically one-celled organisms. How did we make the jump from that to humans, modern humans?
Yeah, so for most of the history of life on Earth, life was pretty boring. I mean, it was essentially bacteria, so probably the most complex organism would have been pond scum, you know, bacterial mats, the kind of things that you might find, say, in a pond in Yellowstone National Park. You know, they're pretty, but they're not very, very complicated. What we think is that sometime about 2 billion years ago, something miraculous happened. And this is the true miracle of life on Earth, that two or more types of bacterial cell collaborated together. They somehow got together and created a much more complicated cell that would have involved many more structures than you would have found inside a bacterial cell, because they essentially joined forces. We don't know how, but what we think happened there was that liberated life to be able to make much more energy than a simple bacterial cell could make. And that was the crucial step that allowed life to go from this sort of tedious bacterial microscopic state to give rise to all of the, what we think of as life now. If you look around and you see life in front of you, you see plants and you see animals, that's only a tiny proportion of life on Earth, but it's the life that really matters. It's the life that is animals and plants and intelligent beings like ourselves. And that appears to have originated through a freak event. We imagine that life on other planets probably gets going quite quickly, but whether complex life, like the kind of life that we see around us, ever gets going anywhere else, we just don't know. And we think it's very unlikely.
Let's get into civilizations. Of course, humans are known to be very social creatures. How were the first human communities organized? I mean, how did we get together?
We talk about anatomically modern humans and behaviorally modern humans. They're essentially indistinguishable from humans that live today. And they probably, there's some dispute over this, but it's probably about 40,000 years ago that those people arose through just ordinary evolutionary processes. Well, I say ordinary evolutionary processes. Evolutionary processes are the most amazing processes that we know of on Earth, but that's another story. For the most time since then, humans lived in small family bands as hunters and gatherers, and that's actually rather different, obviously, from how we live today. The transition from the hunter-gatherer nomadic lifestyle to the sedentary lifestyle is one of the most disputed transitions in prehistory. We think it probably happened about 12,000 years ago. There's this thing called the Neolithic Revolution, when for some reason, and we still don't really know why, people in the Middle East invented this package of technologies: farming, houses, religion, and transport, and pottery. And these are the things that suddenly made that change from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle to a sedentary, farming, settled village lifestyle. It didn't take long from there for cities to spring up. So we know the first cities are 5,000, 6,000 years old. And we don't call them cities lightly. If you'd gone to one of these places, it would have been like a city. They would have had large buildings, transport networks. Most people would be strangers to each other. There would be big shops, there would be marketplaces, there would be places of work and suburbs and all these kind of features. So pretty quickly, humans went from living as we know, say, the Sam Bushman live in southern Africa, to how people in New York and London live now.
Moving on to Chapter 5, Knowledge, and of course the big question there is the origin and development of spoken and written language. How did that come about?
Oh, that's probably one of the most difficult questions that I confronted in the book. Many of the origin stories that we can reconstruct, we're able to reconstruct it because we have physical evidence of fossils or artifacts that have been made by humans, or some other kind of physical evidence like meteorites or comets or something. Language does leave a trace now because we invented writing, but writing massively postdates the origin of language. I think that if you want to ask a dozen linguists where language came from, you'll get 15 different answers. It seems to have been something that has always been part of that package. You know, I talked earlier about the idea of behaviorally modern humans. I think it's fair to assume that behaviorally modern humans, almost by definition, had language, so we can push it back to, say, 40,000 years ago. Some people say it's 2 million years old. Some people say it's 30,000 years old. Some people say it began with gesture. Some people say it began with singing. Some people say it began with single words. These are all kind of these proto-language theories that people talk about.
Invention, Chapter 6, and of course, many people would argue that the wheel was probably the greatest invention man ever came up with. Do you agree?
Well, it certainly was an influential thing. You know, have wheels, we'll travel. But it was a surprisingly late invention. So I talked earlier about the idea that 5,000 or 6,000 years ago there were cities. One of the things that you would not have seen in these cities in Mesopotamia was wheeled transport. And that's quite weird because they'd invented pretty much everything else that you'd associate with a city. And you think that wheels would be essentially a gimme. They're not very complicated. And we actually know that people had invented potter's wheels and water wheels and stuff before they invented wheeled transport. Why did it take so long for people to put two and two together and invent the wheel? And weirdly, it turns out that people probably invented the wheel not in that sort of powerhouse of the Levant, of the Middle East, where all of these other technological innovations were being invented, but in what at the time was a hugely outback kind of somewhere in Central Europe. The first evidence we have of ox-drawn carts is from Germany, which at the time, in comparison with the Middle East, would have been extremely primitive. We don't know why it took so long for people to work out how to build wheeled vehicles. It might have been in the Levant, there were so many camels and donkeys and so on, beasts of burden, that you didn't need to build wheeled transport. And maybe there was a scarcity of animals and oxes and so on in Germany, so people had to be inventive. But again, that's one of the real big mysteries. Why didn't those people who invented almost everything else invent wheels?
That was Graham Lawton, the executive editor of New Scientist magazine and author of the recently released book, New Scientist, The Origin of Almost Everything, and is available through your favorite online bookseller.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this Science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank both of our guests for joining us for today's program. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.